Мейшана Нажаро!
Всак четвертик з'ютрай разом заднього в місяці.
Важкі посипнажі.
Найбільші мецошульці.
Я не висте.
Антихерої.
Черне овце.
Сліпі камермани.
Точні пасисти.
Розігране нюне.
То са згодби, які їх пише жулєнє.
З великими черками.
Ніко-ніко.
Гаоя.
Ніко-ніко.
Гаоя.
Ніко-ніко.
The academic cowards of reaction. The academic cowards of reaction crisscross the jism and the jasm. They do not want to be found out. So they sigh and lie and criminalize silence with the dead pants of shaking in their boots. They are afraid of the just gone and don't want it to return. Because they didn't know what to do when everybody was so animated and fly. They thought, after all, you can understand hiding under the piano, looking for a Victrola or a Defeatrola. You see, that there was too fast a thing happening, and the Chinese screaming, revolution is the main trend. And that rhythm affected the jungle bunnies with no papers and motley whites who went along with the everything stuff. And we know the devil who is now provost of my heart and I, we knows grows. We rose to say, okay, I don't know how to be angry, but I can be boring as a hammock in the good room. You see, we got a degree in degreeing and a PhD in PhDing. We can fake anything but emotion, and you don't need that in college. Lesser do we need that at university. We is very white, if that's still permissible after all. We can stall instead of answer any question with polyvapid bullwinks. Like we said, postmodern, when we understood the righteousness of road warrior in the dead cities, in which we could pontificate that what is ugly is not and what is icy is hot, we said, postmodern, postmodern, and the big guy in the sky penthouse heard us and signaled with a shiny coin of dismal that we were up to the task of lying to hide the flaccid timidity of our mendacity. We could not be cats or dudes or hippies. We like jazz, but only lying down. We are the Kenny G's of poetry, but without the spangles. We make a verse that dare not jangle or tangle with the grim questions that crush the many fools who want to be unleashed. We hold our peace except to say postmodern, which if you understand, that's it. The language, stripped of any diseased opinion, which is bourgeois-like meaning and stories and decision and snappy politics like the colored Stalins that threaten to define us as ignorant as Crazy Eddie. You know, the colleagues stupid enough to give interviews to restaurant owners on how they wax their father and sock through their mother and put a trope in each day eyes so they could describe a world no one understood. But we could analyze as ambiguous with decency. We said then, language, but smell funny. To hook it up with Czechoslovakia. And the wordy birds of no, it has nothing to do with the world. There is no world. Except behind the dead patches where myself used to crawl. Language, pure language, don't you understand? As if you could be a note musician and away with all pests like what it mean or what it say or who it help. We are text ridders and trope conceivers. We are more dizzy than Gates and we ain't Lionel Hampton. Language for us as a long rider on the purple sage of the campus where buxom wet names twist and shout and Little Richard one day will be chair of there because merely by saying language and halting the shit right there, we could make the chairman of our department stare off into his last check. What the heck? I didn't understand Alan Tate either at first, nor why Faulkner was not just a sticky racial mole hanging on the unborn George Wallace peen. Is this interesting or not? Without having to be weighed down by a goddamn narrative and dismissing the notion that what is writ has a writer, again we washed away the bourgeoisie, except ourselves, hiding inside the dumbness of our square misunderstandings. We would be racist, but that's been done. We hate Ginsburg and those guys because they said impossible things. You see, we are textual, Bush too, and our group. By dismissing saying something, we could creep neatly away from commitment or tiptoe with stunning grace away from cranky values like Keats' mistake of truth for a roof over your head and beauty, which, as everyone knows, what the pirates got for stealing the election. Money helps if you got some. It's one reason I don't really go for Negroes. They don't have no money. And don't think our spirit away, our sprint away of what this is, after all, just more bullshit. And don't think our sprint away from what is this, after all, just more bullshit. And don't think our sprint away from what is this, after all, just more bullshit. Like seven types of Amos and Andy, our sense of humor spends as well as money. But niggas, of course, being oral and less than graduates, refuse to think we funny. Even if they say we funny, they mean to be insulting. And we are, after all, the nearest, neatest things to emerge since the fugitive kind. We were right to kill Robert Redford. Who is Tennessee Williams, after all? But the nasty, I realize this is not politically correct. But that's the kind of humor that boils under our paper lips. We are not, like the colored guy said, opportunists or big drags writing dull, ignorant bullshit. F, who keeps insisting things are ugly down home. We are the ghost of Halloween past and Halloween yet to come. We are reclaiming with postmodern the reactionary smells of demands and the Yale condoms of slightly shiny murderers. Sikile! We think all struggle, except to be obscure, is frankly rude. And poetry with some subject or object description of anything except our next raise, our tenure, tete-a-tetes, an article in the exasperated hiney, lewd. And there you see how droll and fantastically empty. We need no one's sympathy. We got tenure in a car. We got trips, sabbaticals to anywhere, so we can scribble like the ishkabibbles of the unreadable. Remember, postmodern is a hip way of saying the world is rotten and must stay rotten to be metaphorically ignored, though funny if you're getting paid, unquote. And all you creeps, even some of my colleagues, are stupid for trying to change any things unless they offer you a better office. Postmodern is what Rudolf Hess said to the people he invited to meet Himmler. Don't you see how stunning? Language without meaning, without narrative, like a clever chum of mine who pointed out that Balzac couldn't be a realist because there was no such thing as reality. Language, just the voids, like ancient Neanderthal boids, with no one to claim it or defame it or name it.
Našemu tehniku ni v čast, da ni bil seznanjen s kako pomembnim dnevom imamo opravka, da tudi vi ne boste ostali v nevednosti do konca dneva. Na današnji dan leta 1925 se je namreč rodil Malcolm X, poslušali pa smo ravno kar Amiri Baraka, prej znanega kot Leroy Jonesa, črnskega pesnika in igralca učitelja, ki je še posebej zaostril svoje poglede po smrti leta Malcolm X-a leta 65. V nadaljevanju pa repetition, copy repetition, že je bilo storjeno, ampak opomniti treba še vedno. Poslušamo intervju z Manning Marablom o življenju Malcolm X-a in pa skupnosti črncov v Ameriki, afroameričanov, kot in danes politično korektno govorimo. Pa poslušajmo tale intervju. Začenjamo pa v Harlemu, nekje drugje.
I've written a great deal about the evolution of African American social protest in the 20th century. One of the key sites, one of the key places where that occurred was in the community of Harlem. Harlem is not the largest black urban community in the United States, not anymore, but there was a period of time between 1920 to 1945 when Harlem was the largest urban black community in the world. And during that time, from after World War I to the end of World War II, there were an extraordinary group of African American and West Indian from the Caribbean leaders who emerged. Marcus Garvey, W.E.B. Du Bois, who founded the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, A. Philip Randolph, who was a very prominent socialist leader and the founder of the first successful black trade union in the United States, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, and the Reverend Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., who was the head of Harlem's most influential church, the Abyssinian Baptist Church. These men were articulate. They had constituencies. They mobilized people regarding social protest and demands from the political system for greater rights and representation on the part of African American people. And Harlem was the center of this. And Harlem was also the center of a flowering of artistic and literary creativity known as the Harlem Renaissance. Poets, playwrights, authors, sculptors, others who made their mark in the field of aesthetics and in culture. So Harlem, both culturally and politically, was a site of resistance, of protest, that had a profound impact upon the African American community throughout the United States. And into the 1950s, as other black communities surpassed Harlem in size, and here I would point to the South Side of Chicago and, say, Watts and Compton in Los Angeles, and here in New York, the black community in Brooklyn, and then later in Queens, are in terms of their demographics, larger than Harlem. Nevertheless, Harlem still remains kind of the symbol of black urbanism for the 20th century, and for the 21st century, for that matter, because today the governor of New York was a representative from Harlem. And there's a long tradition of black political leadership in the last century here in the Northeast coming from Harlem. For example, the most influential black congressperson in Congress today, unquestionably, is Charles Rangel, who is the head of the House Ways and Means Committee. That's the economic committee in Congress, and he is the congressman from Harlem. David Paterson, the governor of New York, is an African-American. He was the state senator from Harlem. So again, Harlem assumes, even to this day in the 21st century, a political significance that outstrips virtually any other black community in the United States.
Would you say that these leaders that come to the to political positions stay true to the interests of the Harlem people?
Well, I think it would be nice if I could say that, but I think that in truth, it's much more complicated. There is a dynamic that I call the kind of paradox of integration. That is, when African Americans were legally segregated, ironically, there was a greater fidelity and responsibility that black leadership felt toward their communities, in part because all blacks, regardless of their class or their education, found themselves racially segregated. And so blacks, if you lived in an African-American community, whether you were wealthy or you were poor, you probably attended a segregated school. You were a part of a church or a faith institution that was all black. Not that you excluded whites, it's that whites simply excluded you from their churches. So blacks built their own churches. That many of the stores that provided food or grocery stores were black-owned. That if you went to a barber, you went to a black person to cut your hair. If you died, you took your relative to be buried at a funeral parlor that was owned by blacks. And that segregation created an environment in which blacks had to rely on themselves to provide goods and services for themselves. Once integration occurred, all of that broke down, so that large businesses that, for the most part, were not owned by blacks, entered the urban ghettos and began to absorb the market, the economic market, for goods and services. And so thousands of black businesses went under. A few made it and expanded during the period of integration, but mostly they did not. And so the political economy of urban America changed. And as a result, the development of, say, black entrepreneurship was stifled and in many ways declined. So today you have central cities like Newark, where there is not a single growth, there's not a single large shopping center or a large grocery store. In a community like Harlem, where there are about 600,000 people, until very recently, until several years ago, there was not a large grocery store servicing that community. So that poor people, this is why in the United States, poor people have much higher rates of socially created deaths. So that you have malnutrition, you have diabetes and deaths from diabetes, but you don't see those kinds of rates of illness in neighborhoods where wealthy people live, And they may only be, half a mile away from extreme poverty. Take, for example, the distance between the Upper East Side of Manhattan and Spanish Harlem, which is, maybe 20 blocks, 20 city blocks. You have the wealthiest wealthiest census tract in the United States is the Upper East Side of Manhattan, where wealthy whites live. And only 20 blocks away, you have one of the poorest urban sites in the United States, which is East Harlem.
Okay, and if we stay with Harlem, Malcolm X, to many a very controversial person, came out of Harlem. He lived there for many years after he came there when finishing studies. For you, he's the most influential black leader of the 20th century. Why?
I think that Malcolm came to symbolize black urbanism for a couple reasons. His emergence in the 1950s and 60s galvanized millions of African Americans to see themselves in a different way. That he challenged white supremacy in the United States and also the power of the U.S. government. He called at the end of his life for a coalition of people of color, of Asians and Africans and black Americans, to challenge U.S. imperialism. And he took his case both to international venues, where he petitioned the Organization of African Unity, as well as the United Nations, calling upon the United States to end its genocidal policies against African American people. Malcolm was the first prominent American to denounce the war in Vietnam, years before Martin Luther King Jr., years before white American political leaders broke with the Johnson administration against the war in Vietnam. Malcolm X was challenging the administration and calling for an end to this unjust war. So in terms of his anti-imperialism, his focus against the war, and then finally Malcolm, as he left the sectarian Nation of Islam, an organization that he had been recruited to while he had been in prison. Once he left prison, he built the organization, then came to the realization that the Nation of Islam was sectarian, that it did not reflect what he would describe as true Islam, traditional Sunni Islam. He went on a Hajj to Mecca, recognizing that under true Islam, true Islam was colorblind in theory. And again, sometimes not in practice, but in theory, that it recognizes the humanity of all people, regardless of color or race. Malcolm embraced this definition of Islam, and building from it, came to the realization that the underlying tension and the fundamental challenge between people throughout the planet was not based on color, it was based on class. Malcolm said at the end of his life, "All my life I used to believe that the struggle was between white and black. Now I understand," he said, "that the fundamental struggle is between the haves versus the have-nots." So Malcolm X charted a path challenging structural inequality and economic injustice. And that was his message to the masses of blacks in the United States. It was a message that many middle-class African-American leaders have been afraid to embrace because of its revolutionary character. Malcolm was assassinated in part to silence the kind of evolution and the radicalism that he was undergoing. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated 3 years later because he was undergoing a similar kind of transformation. That Dr. King came out against the war in Vietnam. He called for a poor people's march on Washington, D.C. to challenge the Johnson administration's failure to address the continuing burden of poverty in the society. Martin called for the need to internationalize the struggles of African Americans and to reach out to progressive people throughout the world to put pressure on the U.S. government for its unjust domestic and foreign policies. So he ends up being assassinated. So there is a long tradition in the United States of either assassinating black leaders or silencing them by stripping them of their citizenship rights or their right to travel, taking their passports away. This is what occurred in the 1950s with Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, the founder of the NAACP, and the great Paul Robeson, who was a great artist and singer and actor, whose both of their passports were denied to them for 7 or 8 years. They were stripped of their right to travel throughout the world. Their income plummeted. And so there is this official, they were made non-persons, very much like under the old Soviet Union, of what occurred with people like Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn. So we have in the United States political prisoners that remain today incarcerated. We also have the disproportionate number of people who are in prison are very low-income people, and the criminal justice system works as a way of warehousing the unemployed. Of those 2.3 million people who are in prison, most of either about a third of them were unemployed at the time of their arrests, and the others averaged less than $20,000 annual income in the year prior to their arrest. So the vast majority of people who are incarcerated in the U.S., regardless of what they've been charged with, are poor people, and they are disproportionately brown and black, but, you know, they are poor people. And, you know, so that the country continues to function in a way to suppress legitimate dissent. So this is part of why Malcolm is so important, because he symbolizes in many real ways a break with this kind of both white supremacy and economic injustice.
Your book on Malcolm X is titled A Life of Reinvention. What kind of reinvention are you talking about?
Malcolm continued to remake himself throughout his life. He was born Malcolm Little in Omaha, Nebraska. He, during the course of his life, he underwent a series of changes. When he was a teenager, his nickname was Detroit Red. He was involved in urban crime. He was a, you know, kind of a small petty gangster in Harlem during the 1940s. He was imprisoned for 7 years for several robberies. During his life in prison, he experienced an epiphany or a metamorphosis where he joined a sectarian Islamic group, the Nation of Islam, which combined elements of traditional Islam with kind of black separatism, headed up by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He became a devotee of this organization. When he was released from prison in 1952, he emerged rapidly as a major figure within the group. He personally helped to establish over 60 mosques throughout the United States from 1952 to 1962. But in the course of his development, he came to realize the contradictions and problems inherent in this sectarian group, and also the hypocrisy and the contradictions of the leader who had engaged in extramarital affairs and also in corruption. And so Malcolm broke from the organization, building his own groups, Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which reached out to the Sunni community, and the Organization of Afro-American Unity, a secular group that attempted to mobilize African-Americans, regardless of their faith or religion, to engage in political struggle with the state, with the government. And this was really where Malcolm was going at the end of his life. So there are a series of changes. That's why the subtitle of the book is The Life of Reinvention. The listeners may want to access my website on Malcolm, which documents many of the interviews I've done. It's www.malcolmxproject. That's one word, malcolmxproject.net. And you can see many of the interviews and a lot of film clips and photographs of Malcolm X.
Dr. Marable, the quest for freedom and understanding of freedom has been great among the Afro-Americans. But do you see a change? Can you explain if they understand the term freedom differently from the white perspective?
Absolutely. In the United States, there have been two fundamental ways of defining the word freedom. For most white Americans, freedom means freedom from the government, freedom from the state. They have a libertarian notion, definition of the meaning of freedom that comes close to the concept of liberty. To be freed means that you are not under a regime that controls your decision-making. You can decide to do whatever you want to do. In our Constitution of the United States, there are a series of guarantees, which are amendments to the Constitution. The Second Amendment it states that you have a right to bear arms, that any citizen can own a gun, basically. The First Amendment states that you have freedom of expression, the right of free speech and free expression. You can write what you want as long as you don't libel someone. So that white Americans have thought about freedom in ways that say that I don't have to take responsibility for others as long as I can do whatever I want as long as I don't libel someone or harm them. For African Americans, there's a very different way of thinking about freedom. It's not freedom from the government. It is freedom. It is the freedom that flows from certain guarantees by the government. Because African Americans arrived here as chattel slaves, and for 200 and nearly 50 years of our 400 years on North American soil, we were defined as property. We have a very different relationship to the U.S. government than white Americans do. Our definition is that it's only through the government, through Abraham Lincoln and the federal government, that slavery was abolished. It was only through Lyndon Johnson and the Congress that racial segregation laws were abolished in 1964. It was only through the guarantees of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 that millions of blacks were finally allowed to vote in a country where they were nominally citizens but could not exercise the right of voting. So our whole relationship to rights issues is quite different than white Americans. And so African Americans, I guess in European terms, would be essentially social democrats or democratic socialists regarding their notions of fairness and justice, what the government should provide for people. The vast majority of African Americans favor universal health care and universal education. They would favor governmental support for providing shelter or decent housing for everyone in the country, regardless of race, whereas most white Americans would not be supportive of these things. So that politically, the most advanced and progressive element within the U.S. population tends to be African American. And I say this not because I am an African American. I'm saying this because the historical development of blacks was such that it created among African Americans a recognition that to achieve substantive change for the most disadvantaged populations required the power of the state, the power of government. in beneficial ways, in constructive ways. Whereas for most white Americans, there is no such recognition. They believe in part in the market, in the capitalist market, providing the resources that address people's needs. Whereas black Americans have little, if any, faith in the market, because if we left it up to the market, slavery would still exist. So they recognize that the power of the state is the chief guarantor of their rights and their ability to achieve freedom. And so their definition of freedom is quite different.
You've already pointed out some of the divisions and problems that remain today. But how would you say, in your opinion, would the leaders of the past, like Malcolm X, etc., build the resistance today in the USA, which is, as it seems to me, from Slovenia, non-existent?
Well, there's different forms of resistance exist that no longer look the way they did in the 1960s, but nevertheless, they do exist, and they take place in different ways. For example, in the United States, culturally, one of the chief phenomena that has emerged is what is called the hip-hop movement. Hip-hop culture is the music and the graffiti and the art and dancing of a generation, two generations of blacks and Hispanics in urban America. It first emerged in the middle 1970s here in the Bronx and then in Queens and in Manhattan, and then became a worldwide phenomenon by the 1990s. There are political activists that use hip-hop music and culture for educational and political purposes. Here in New York State, for example, Russell Simmons, who is a chief architect of the hip-hop movement, became a leader in demanding changes in sentencing laws, especially for low-income and black and Hispanic people, regarding criminal justice. There were demonstrations that he led with young people, teenagers and people in their early 20s, in downtown Manhattan, calling for an end to cutbacks in the educational budget for public schools. So that protest, that one protest that was organized in 2002, brought together the teachers union and 50,000 young people from the schools who are listening to hip-hop music and who were brought out because of hip-hop artists. So the mobilization of the 1960s and 70s was quite different than the mobilizations for economic rights, for education, for housing, for health care today. But even though they appear differently, nevertheless, such protests do exist.
So you remain positive?
I remain hopeful of the possibility of transforming the United States to a more democratic and just society.